welcome to Exiting Through the 2010s, a podcast where we reflect and dissect the movies of the past 10 years. I'm your host, Jack Draper. With me is my co-host, Clay Williams.
I, too, am not a real person yet.
That's good to know.
I'm not a real person yet, and I don't know if I ever will be. I don't own any credit cards. I'm just not a real person yet, and I think that's what this movie really showed me, is I'm just not real.
Do you have a social security number?
Oh, I do. I can't remember it for the life of me, and I'm supposed to remember.
Well, just look it up right now and tell us.
I have a note. I have a notes page on my phone that, like, I put like my most private information on that I cannot remember. It's locked because it gives me some sense of security, but like, I have my social security number on my phone just because I can't remember it for the life of me.
Do you think Noah Baumbach keeps his social security number in his notes?
He puts it in his wallet. I bet he wrote like this nice, like, with great penmanship little sticky note and put it in his wallet.
Thank you guys for inviting me, by the way. I feel like I should say that up front. This is the first time that I've actually ever been invited to anything, actually. I think that's just a sign that I'm moving on up. Like, I'm becoming an invitable person. And, you know, it's upward mobility, as the old folks say.
Jack suggested bringing you on very early on in the podcast.
I feel honored. Speaking of Noah Baumbach, I don't know when the right time is to, like, tell this story, but I did meet him, actually. I met him at an event that he was giving, like, some kind of Q&A at. He was at a theater in New York. He was presenting Letter from an Unknown Woman by Max Ophuls. I, like, went there kind of, like, specifically to shake his hand. Like, I just told myself, okay, I'm coming to this thing. As long as I can shake his hand, like, afterwards, I'm good. I can like, I've checked it off my box. I can leave. And in the theater, I kind of just had this, like, existential moment. I just kind of, like, was watching the movie, and then I just kind of started to get a strong sense of, like, God and the universe and everything. And I just, like, started seeing these, like, people up on the screen. I was like, oh my God, who are we? Like, where are we? What in the world is time? Like, I wasn't even high or anything. This was just completely just normal, just kind of maybe the claustrophobia of being trapped in the theater or whatever it was. I just kind of started trying to see God in the movie and this and that. And whatever happened, the movie ended, the lights came on, Noah did his, like, little Q&A, but I was just like, I just met God. I don't really care about meeting Noah Baumbach anymore. And I told myself, I was like, okay, I still got to shake his hand. I still got to do that. So, like, I go up to him. I'm like, hi, Noah, it's me. I'm, like, you know, huge fan. You know, Francis Ha is, like, one of my 10 favorite movies, which it is. It still is. And he was like, okay, thanks. And I shook his hand and that was that. But yeah, it was just mainly just the whole, like, coming there to meet someone famous and then just kind of having this, like, weird, unexpected spiritual moment. And then just like, okay, nothing really matters anymore. Who cares about famous people?
Do you think when you met God, do you think it was Greta Gerwig?
I don't know. It was strange. I was just thinking about how kind of, like, every moment is, like, how time isn't real. Every moment's just kind of preserved in eternity. We're just kind of moving through time. And so I kind of thought about God as kind of this, like, museum curator who's just kind of, like, preserving moments in, like, the museum of infinite time. Like, you know, God is just wandering through the museum. It's like, and here's every piece of art that's ever been created, and everything that's ever been lost is just kind of kept right here in this, like, infinitely large building.
Had you thought about why it was at that moment, or was it just something spontaneous that you had that?
I don't really know. Maybe there was something about the movie. I don't know. I don't really want to see that one again. I think I had the biggest experience I'll ever have with that movie. And if I saw it a second time, that it wouldn't top that.
Yeah. And that was at the Francis Ha Q&A?
It was no. He was doing a Q&A for the movie, the movie that he was presenting. It was just like an old film that he happened to be a fan of that he was trying to introduce to everyone else.
I see. Okay. Nice.
Yeah, this is really distracting for Francis Ha.
No. I was just thinking if you gave me 100 guesses of how this podcast would start, talking about God would not be one of them. But yeah. I'm really glad we did.
We're here for it.
Yes.
I feel pressured to introduce you formally, so we have Julia Rhodes on this week. Welcome.
Thank you. That's really getting the ball rolling here,
right?
which we badly need to do.
So I just wanted to ask you, like I told you before, I am a really big fan of Essential Films. I think you did a really great job with it, especially your After Hours video.
Oh boy, I really didn't think that one was
so cool. Good. I loved it. It's
After
Hours is one of my favorite movies, and it's just like I've never seen something constructed quite like that.
Well, there's so many pieces in that movie that the movie is kind of begging you to fit together, and I wanted to fit those pieces together. Like, I wanted to show people, hey, this line of dialogue matches up with this scene that happens later. This scene matches up with this scene that happens earlier. I wanted to just visually show that without really...
The puzzle pieces are all there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how did that channel start? Like, what do you remember what caused the idea for? Because video essay channels are obviously another big part of film criticism this decade.
I can say a bit about that. I was in my first year of college. In high school, that's when I got into movies for the first time. I started doing this film blog to kind of like keep track of my like reactions and ratings to like different movies that I saw. And that just became tedious. It became exhausting. No one read it except for my grandfather, and he died. And so then no one read it. And then I told myself, okay, well, YouTube's where everything's happening. Maybe I should just go to YouTube. And so I just started doing YouTube videos.
Nice.
I think the YouTube people that I was looking at the time, the Nerd Writer was a big influence.
Yeah.
And then Every From a Painting, obviously.
Yeah.
I watched The Nostalgia Critic back then. I too was touched by The Devilish One. But I think people were telling me that I talked too fast in my early videos. And I think the reason that I was okay with talking fast is because I also liked Bob Chipman. I also kind of liked Movie Bob's like hour long deep dives into specific movies like Avengers or Ghostbusters. And he talks extremely fast in his videos, but it's not hard for me to keep up with him. And so I think because of that, I thought, okay, well, if I talk fast, it's okay. Oh my God, there's a silverfish on my wall. Oh goodness. Killed it.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Hey, you gotta do what you gotta do. Yeah, no, Movie Bob talks extremely fast. See, I personally...
Who is this? I haven't heard of this person.
I don't know how to describe him. He's Movie Bob. He's this video essayist who works for The Escapist, I think. But yeah, I'm never bothered by people talking extremely fast. I actually like that. Personally.
The reason that I was interested in making the channel, and this is the reason I talk about all these influences and inspirations, is that I felt like everyone on YouTube at the time was just talking about bad movies and riffing on bad movies. So that's kind of the point of mentioning Nostalgia Critic or I Hate Everything or Your Movie Sucks or Ralph the Movie Maker. Is all these people. They just like
Cinema
they just
Sins.
Talk about this movie sucked. This movie, like, you know, like, let's dive into this movie and have fun tearing at it. And I was just like, no, I want to look at the best. I want to look at the best of the best. There's some good stuff out there. And I guess the idea of assembling a cultural canon really appealed to me, of just saying, hey, these are the ones that I think everyone should see. I mean, they're important. And I think my opinion on that has definitely changed over time. I mean, right now, I think if I had the chance to start the channel again, I would not have done it the way I did it. I would have probably picked a different theme or a different idea to go around, but I'm thinking about ways to take it forward, thinking about just talking about whatever film I want to talk about at the time so that my passion is really in the video.
Yeah, and since there's no theme, I guess it gives you that freedom to do that. Like, you can go from...
I'll still be going back to this idea of the canon, and I'll still be kind of thinking about assembling that, but maybe assembling it in a more straightforward way.
Yeah, because there's no restriction from going from Aguirre, The Wrath of God, to Boys in the Hood. You know,
yeah. Like
there's really just the two sides of the coin.
Mm-hmm. So, that being said, I would put Francis Ha in the canon. I would do that. I
don't think you have a video on Francis Ha, right?
I don't. I probably might make one soon. I really, really love this film. It's my favorite drama, by the way. And drama is not a genre that I particularly enjoy, believe it or not. There's so many amazing films out there that are dramas, but I think that drama, just kind of films that take place in the normal world and with normal life and normal people just kind of working through their different, you know, emotional and dramatic situations, I think it's maybe the least cinematic of like the genres. I think that movies kind of lend themselves to... They kind of lend themselves to spectacle. They kind of lend themselves to showing you something that you can't see anywhere else. I think that drama kind of is a more psychological genre, is maybe even better suited for theater or literature. But that being said, I think every now and then one of them really wins me over, and this one did.
Yeah, I think drama is such a hard genre to even encapsulate.
Yeah, for sure.
Let alone like or dislike.
I have very like radical extreme ideas about some things in film.
And I think you could say it is psychological, but then you're like, oh well, but then there's horror, then there's thriller, then there's And so I guess for me it would be the one that shows the most human emotion without veering into too much comedy or too much of what we fear or too much of what there is to explore in science fiction. So I guess the one that's most like that you can almost film a play, like you can do Doubt, I guess that's like drama, you know, capital D drama.
Yeah. I mean, comedy is a human emotion. Fear is a human emotion. And so is, imagination that like all these other genres, they exist to kind of explore these emotions. They're just exploring the emotions in more vivid colors, focusing on one emotion. And I think maybe what you're kind of suggesting here is that drama is really kind of trying to capture the whole end of the spectrum, like the whole spectrum at once.
I think for me with drama is what I look for in a good drama is intimacy. How intimate I am with the characters and the betrayal and the story and the situation. How much do I feel centered and grounded in what I am watching? Mm-hmm. And like when I think of that kind of description, I think of a Separation. There's a lot of like these like family or not like not when I mean family, I mean like these like family dynamics or these like what's another one? Directed by Lynn Ramsey, Morven Keller. Like those really like intimate dramas of a person with a life, a reality, a set of morals, a set of ideas, ambition, fears, that kind of stuff. And so it was like my first time seeing Francis Ha, and I think. Oh, that's my dog, sorry. But genres can be so silly sometimes in the sense of what you limit, what you identify as a drama. And this is very dramatic, but it's also what I found to be, you know, it is comedic-ish. I mean, it's Baumbach. It's always going to have some comedy themes, but like it made the drama much more, I guess, intimate, if I had to use the word again.
It's his French New Wave movie to me. It's like his kind of sporadic, upbeat, kind of melancholy ennui film about those who are kind of lost, but also of people who are also supporting them around that lost soul. So it's kind of like, you know, I see a lot of Cleo from 5 to 7 in here. I see a lot of 400 Blows in here, but
I definitely see his homages to the French New Wave in this, and I think that's what makes it so refined, being what it is. But I think getting to the heart of what its appeal is for me is that, as opposed to kind of other dramatic or other drama films, which are very much kind of about some character trying to overcome some obstacle or some character trying to move through some kind of story, Francis Ha doesn't have a story, really. And it feels like it's just taking a year out of this person's life and just showing you that year as it is. Like, life isn't very organized. It kind of you meander from place to place as you're trying to figure yourself out. And that's what this one is really about. It's just kind of about trying to capture life kind of in the clumsy, disorganized way that it is. And there was something about that, despite this film's stylistic choices, because stylistically, there are some things that are very realist about it, but there are some also formalist tendencies in the film. But it felt very realistic to me for what it was. It felt very real. I connected to the characters a lot. The dialogue especially, I just felt, this sounds like real people. This sounds like how real people talk and what they talk about. And that just blew me away, I think, more than anything else with this.
Do you remember the first time that you saw this?
Oh, I wish I did. Probably on Netflix, maybe. Sometime around when I graduated from high school. So.
Yeah, I think that was for me too. I think I saw this in high school, maybe around the time Meyerowitz came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I saw it on, do you guys know What the Flick on YouTube? That was like this group of critics from Los Angeles. They would have this weekly, you know, weekly release, new release show, and they would review it. It has like Alonzo Duralde and Christian Lemire. And I used to watch them in high school, because whenever you type in XYZ movie review, there'll be always the first result. And they reviewed Francis Ha one time, and I was just like, oh, I think this is something I should check out, because they really like this one. And it turned out, I think I saw that spring, and then Meyerowitz came out that fall. So then I kind of had some. So, and I think I may have saw Squid and the Whale prior. So maybe I didn't know the name Noah Baumbach, but I also did. You know,
You knew the man, not the name.
Yeah. And I just remember knowing how much I loved the sound of the dialogue in Squid and the Whale, like just not even picking up on subtext or anything, just how it's almost like I was not expecting the characters to say what they would say, but it would be perfect to fit that character and what they were saying. And yeah, I think Noah Baumbach has meant a lot to me since then. He's just, I love, you know, Mistress America and Marriage Story. I've really only disliked Margot at the Wedding. And yeah, so he's pretty consistent for me. And he has like a great run this decade.
Yeah, for sure. He's definitely, I kept talking and people said, Noah Baumbach, who's that? And now everyone knows. Like now he's a much bigger figure. Marriage Story kind of became a national sensation. And I looked and I said, oh, finally, his big break. But I wanted to talk about kind of the formalism of the film. And I think that kind of goes against some of its New Wave influences, because the New Wave was kind of this rebellion against formalism, sort of. But a lot of the shots in this, kind of as opposed to the more chaotic kind of French New Wave films, the shots in this film are very composed. They're very organized. It's black and white like a French New Wave film. It uses a lot of French New Wave music, and it uses, like the French New Wave, some very playful editing. But it's very much Baumbach's kind of own thing. It's very much his own style. He's very controlled with it. He really wants it to look very nice and crafted. but in a way that you can kind of forget about and kind of seep into it, sort of.
And the camera's always very...
You feel like you're in the room.
The camera's very stationary with his movies, but it's never stale.
That's what I'm trying to say.
He draws this gray area of improvisation and like rehearsal with his scenes too. Mm-hmm. I think the big obvious example, the most recent example, is the one with the manila envelope in Marriage Story, where it's like it almost acts like a 40s screwball comedy. And this I think is full of those scenes too, where it's almost like this is sporadic, but has some kind of semblance to it.
Yeah. With this one, actually, it's amazing because people say, oh, much of this was probably improvised. But Baumbach's response to that was actually but Baumbach and Gerwig said that less of it was improvised than you think. That a lot of it is just really, really good script writing.
Yeah, I can believe that. I mean, yeah, because I feel like if Gerwig... I don't know, I feel like if, you know, if Gerwig co-writing, for some reason, I would feel like that would be there would be less improv because... she's coming in knowing exactly what she wants to say in a certain scene because, I mean, the whole film is centered around her. So I feel like if she's already kind of planned and understood what her approach is to a certain scene, that there would be less improv in her mind. Because she feels like she's already kind of figured it out and how it's art. And she already knows this. She knows where this scene is put into the entire movie. Like, she knows the structure of it. She knows, like, what she needs to get at, the emotions she needs to reach, and the overall, how she understands how to progress the plot. And improv can be great, but sometimes it can be overdone and also feel like there is no actual focus to a scene. It's just, it just meanders. It's just free-flowing, and there's no real end or point to it. And I think every single line in this movie feels like there is a point to it. It's leading somewhere.
I love that. That definitely makes sense. This is a film about Gerwig. It's semi-autobiographical, and in a way, it kind of feels like Lady Bird is a spiritual prequel to this, sort of, where Lady Bird is kind of about
Gerwig's.
Yeah, it's Greta Gerwig's life in Sacramento, and this is about Greta Gerwig's life in New York. And so I look at this film, and it's like I'm seeing the same character, but at different stages of their life. And
definitely.
Yeah, I think what this film is really about, I think, is about friendship. It's about a really close friendship, but there's some like romantic tension between Francis and Sophie, but not in the way that one would traditionally think, where it's like black and white, two categories, where it's okay, either they're friends or they're something more than that. There's this kind of gray area in between. And I think that's trying to say I think sometimes when a friendship becomes really close, it can be a little bit complicated. It can be a little bit emotionally messy, but it, in a way that you can't really put labels on from the outside. And I think that that's definitely what's going on with Francis and Sophie here. It's not necessarily like a heterosexual or homosexual thing. It's just there's this bond that is only understood by them.
Mm. Yeah, I think you could even read into it, and it wouldn't be impossible to say Sophie got the new boyfriend as a distraction to Francis. Or maybe even similarly, Francis broke up with that boyfriend at the very beginning to take her mind off, to be free and be with Sophie more. Maybe that boyfriend was limiting time with Sophie.
Yeah, I think that's definitely what's going on. And I also think that there's this kind of moment in the middle of the film where she's at the dinner party and she learns that Sophie is moving to Japan with her boyfriend, and she just gets so emotionally distraught over it. She says, no, I'm not drinking anymore. And then she gets the news and she just immediately starts pouring herself some wine, and she immediately gets drunk sort of at this party. And she starts talking about, as she's thinking about Sophie, she's talking about like, I the one thing I want in life is to like look across the room and smile at someone and think, oh, that's my person. That's the person. And at the end of the film, she has that moment with Sophie. That's how the film ends.
Yeah.
Is with her looking across the room and looking at Sophie, and there's just this shared smile between them that no matter, like, regardless of everything that's happened over the course of all of this, the connection between them is still valid. It's still...
It's like a reaffirmation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I also think that the whole line of her talking about, like, that feeling of looking across the room and seeing that person, I actually have it pulled up. It's not because you're possessive or it's precisely sexual, but because that is your person in this life, and it's funny and sad, but only because this life will end and it is the secret world that exists right there in public, unnoticed, that no one else knows about. It's a sort of like how they say that other dimensions exist all around us, but we don't have the ability to perceive them. That's what I want out of a relationship or just life, I guess. And I think, like, that line goes so beautifully with, like, I mean, of course it connects to it, but it feels like each part of what she says is realized in that moment at the end. Like, the entire core and fundamental idea of what she's trying to express in all of those words is shown so beautifully. And it is very much, like, I guess, like, you know, if you look at every movie and say every movie has a thesis, that is the thesis, is that feeling, that emotion, that connection with someone, whether it be romantic or platonic, who cares? And I think that's just what makes this movie special. But I also like how this movie is not all about Sophie. It's about Francis and other things. Like, Julia, you were talking about something earlier about how this movie kind of just, it feels like it's just a year. There's no real build up or anything. I love how it just drops us in. It has no, mm-hmm. There's no prelude. There's no introduction. It just, boom, we're in. And it's an hour, 20 minutes of just this person's life. But it also, I don't know. I think it reaches a sense of, I don't want to say realism, because I think sometimes realism can be overrated, but the idea of something.
And that's such a broad term, too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I think intimacy
would be the right word, and I keep saying that over and over again, but that's what this movie brings true to me. Even though it's like a comedy and it's super fun and breezy and, you know, extremely entertaining, I do find it to be an intimate portrait of Francis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think going back kind of on, like, the gender and sexuality kind of angle, I think there's kind of, like, Francis does have kind of, like, lesbian or even asexual kind of vibes at points, like, with, especially with her relationships with kind of, like, the men in her life, where she moves into this apartment with these two guys, and you think, oh, all sorts of tension is going to, like, erupt from that, but then they just end up being, like, brothers to her. They just kind of are tackling each other like siblings. And she kind of just like initiates this sibling kind of relationship with everyone that she kind of runs into.
Plus it's tough with baby Adam Driver.
Yeah. Yeah. And the, with going back to kind of the film structure, is I feel like with films, I tend to kind of care more about the environments than anything else. Is a film to me is less about story and characters. I mean, those things are important, but I think I'm kind of different than other people in the sense that I just love a film that's just kind of an environment that's enjoyable to be in, and then the film is just an exploration of that environment. And it's not like this environment focus is very much an ecosystem of interconnecting scenes and characters and imagery and themes. And that's what I love to see.
It definitely is. The environment is definitely used to accentuate everything. I agree. Environment is a very important part. And this is like, you know, someone can make the case that New York is overused in movies, but I do really like this New York. I like seeing this kind of New York in black and white. I like this idea of it's not necessarily, it doesn't have the stereotypical, like, it doesn't have that stereotypical, like, personality of New York. It's just kind of like, it is a backdrop, but it also is just like it's more like a lifestyle in the sense of, rather than this, like, otherworldly place. It's not, it doesn't seem mythical like some movies make it, or nightmarish. It's just kind of exists. Exactly.
I love the use of New York in this too. I think Francis' theme seems like a little like fish in this big sea. I mean, that's so obvious. Yeah. It's New York City, but it seems so much bigger than what we're led to believe in the 80 minutes we're here. And she's so lost too, so I think that makes it feel bigger. And
yeah. I agree. She's very overwhelmed by life, so it makes it feel like she's out of her depth, because I mean, in a sense we all are. And being in New York really really adds to that feeling of what am I doing?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the environment focus, I just really like films that take place in urban environments. And in fact, my other favorite film that takes place in an urban environment, which is also coincidentally New York, After Hours. And so I would really love to do a Francis Ha After Hours double feature, where it's like one is kind of like the bright sunny day, and the other one's kind of like a dark night. And I really love the music. I love the scene where she's dancing to Modern Love. That's just absolute iconic cinema. It was my wallpaper for quite some time.
Modern Love in this movie is like synonymous to me now. I've only seen it the twice, but.
And even that's a reference to something else. It's a reference to like Mauvais Sang, like a French film starring Denis Levant. But but it becomes something completely different when Baumbach uses it in the way that he does. And the same thing actually for the more kind of understated Everyone's a Winner sequence, where she's in Paris and like there's like the spotlights that are coming out of the Eiffel Tower, and she's kind of walking along the French River. It's wonderful. I love so many of the individual sequences in this film. I love so many of the individual moments. It's kind of like walking through a forest and you get to these landmarks, and you get to the end and she has this beautiful dance that she's executed. And I love that dance scene at the end, not just because of how interesting it looks to me, but how it embodies Frances's whole energy. She says, I love things that look like mistakes. So the whole thing is kind of clumsy and cluttered, just like her, just like the film is at times. But it's also a culmination of her entire career arc. It's learning to live life by herself, learning to be her own person, and learning to be to kind of advance, and watching her go from kind of this like smaller kind of like understudy character to actually advancing in her career goals after a very kind of troubled and scattered path throughout much of the movie. It's really satisfying. It's really satisfying to see Frances.
Yeah, it's really cathartic. It's like we don't know if dance is not even something she wants to pursue full time, and I don't really think it may matter in that last scene, because I see it as this is just something that she's proud of, right?
I think dance is actually much more central to the film. I think that the film itself is kind of a dance. Like that's what I was talking about, kind of with the Modern Love sequence and the Everyone's a Winner sequence, is the movie is dancing in those moments. Whenever a movie is kind of paired with music, the movie is dancing. And the way that actors move their bodies in certain scenes, like a film is kind of a dance. There's these parallels between film and dance that this film is crafting. And I think what's so powerful and kind of mystical about dance is that humans are one of the few species that does that. Very few animals like interact with music in the way that humans do. There are some interesting videos that you should look see of birds and sea lions moving to music. But I think that there's something very powerful and magical and expressive about the human ability to express themselves through music, to kind of channel the music through their bodies. I mean, In the Cuban religion of Santeria, they believe that dancing to specific rhythms actually possesses them with certain spirits, that if you listen to a certain drum beat and start moving to it, that you're actually channeling a god by kind of moving to that drum beat. And so, I mean, dance has so many different properties and qualities. And so I think that, like, Frances Ha kind of captures kind of the magic of dance and the kind of the way that it does and the way that it displays human bodies in the way, yeah. And yeah, the joy of it, the joy of it particularly, the joy of dance. And that's Frances.
And, you know, well, even every great movie soundtrack has to have a purpose, you know, and it's like even if a movie uses music to create an energy and it's like obvious needle drops, then that's the only real time that you can say that it was a wasted moment. But yeah, it's like 95% of the time it's probably for a specific purpose.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of wasted needle drops out there in movies, and they frustrate me every time because it doesn't have to be that way. There's so many great songs out there, and there's so many great ways to utilize them.
I agree. I do really like the score to this movie. It's a very distinctive choice. For some reason, throughout the movie, I kept thinking about, like, because it has a very, I don't know, it doesn't, it feels, I forget, I don't know what, I'm horrible with music, so I don't know what instrument it is, but, like, it feels like a ukulele throughout, like, it's just, yes, like, this, like, you know, light, you know, acoustic, breezy sound, and it's a very distinctive choice to me, because it's, you don't really see that in films, like, for some reason, it reminded me of The Third Man, where the score choice for The Third Man is a zither. And yeah, I've always found that to be wild. And I'm just like, a zither. You know, like, who chooses that to be their actual score? And that kind of reminded me in this movie of just, like, this was a very distinctive choice to really add an element of, you know, breeziness, life, bewilderment, that kind of idea of, okay, all of this is happening, we're going through it. And it's also particularly great in, like, especially the needle drops and, like, these really great montages of whether it's in Sacramento or in Paris. I think they incorporate the music really well in those moments because it feels, I mean, also the editing is really well done. It just kind of, it flows really well.
When Frances goes to Sacramento, I was like the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood meme. It's like, ah, it's like Lady Bird.
yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. Her parents are Unitarian Universalists in this movie.
They're actually Greta Gerwig's real parents.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's very true.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. And so, wait, what Unitarian, what are, I'm sorry, I was one of my questions. I'm like, I didn't understand what religious ceremony they were practicing in.
I can tell you all about that. Greta Gerwig's parents were Unitarian Universalists. And you didn't see much of that in Lady Bird, but you actually get a clearer window into that here. So Unitarian Universalism began as kind of an offshoot of Christianity, but it kind of expanded into kind of the sect of Christianity that was much more deist. It was much less, okay, there's you know, God and Jesus and everything, and Unitarians, that's okay, well, maybe our understanding of God should be much more basic. It should be much more pantheistic. It's there's one God, there's one kind of, like, and then universalism is, okay, well, and everyone kind of gets accepted. And so it becomes this kind of attempt to create this, like basic religion, sort of, not mm-hmm. like part of any particular sect or doctrine, but there's just, okay, it's Unitarian Universalism is basically kind of like the religion for spiritual but not religious people, where there's this acknowledgement of the kind of sanctity of the human spirit, and there's this acknowledgement that there's some kind of larger force out there, and there's mm-hmm. there's this acknowledgement of this spiritual importance to harmony with nature, but it's much more it's very free flowing. People can kind of come and introduce ideas to each other and just talk about them. And there's not any like overarching leadership of believe this and don't believe this. It's interesting. I attended one of their services at one point, just kind of out of curiosity, and it was really interesting. But
that's fascinating. Yeah. I now want to go to one of their services, because at first when I saw it, I'm like, okay, what is this? Because I've never seen a service like this before. And for some reason it might pop in my head, this isn't Scientology, is it? Is Scientology a thing in Sacramento?
And I'm just, it's not, just it's like, not really like a, yeah, it's not really like a cult. It's just kind of like its own thing. And it, like, so I recognize it because of the hymn book that you see in that scene. And also the kind of chalice, which is like a symbol of them, and kind of like what they do is this like flaming, this flaming cup, or I might have it wrong, just a flame, like the UU flame.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they just really like sweaters and guitars. That's just, they're really into that. And
It looks great.
It's very cozy. It's just like the group of people, they just like get together in a cozy room and they just like have fun being cozy. But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about that is that when Greta Gerwig directed Little Women, I saw that as being kind of connected to her Unitarian Universalist upbringing, because Louisa May Alcott, author of Little Women, was kind of a precursor to those beliefs. She was, I think she was Unitarian, or and so like Louisa May Alcott's kind of very humanitarian values, I think became of particular importance to the UU community. And I think that kind of it was kind of her upbringing in that community that exposed her to Little Women as kind of like such a, you know, central text. And you can see that in Little Women as this kind of that important to the movie and important to the story that's being adapted is this kind of sense of celebrating and appreciating human goodwill. And spreading that, and you can see that in like the charity that the sisters in that movie extend to the people in the local community, the poor family.
Mm. Yeah, because that's not like the religion is all over Little Women. It's very much subtextual or hidden details. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a film major, religion minor. So one of my things with looking at films is I try to look at where religion shows up in film and how that's used and what that means.
That's very interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
That's kind of what led me into
two and two
that.
Making four. Yeah.
I kind of like have laser eyes like with when anything like that shows up in a film.
Even if
like,
you don't
okay,
want
what can
to
I make out of this? What can I turn this into?
That's great. Yeah, that's definitely. That's a great combination, honestly. A combination I didn't think of. Film major, religion minor. Yeah, that's great. That's really cool. Yeah, because like I mean, a lot.
What'd you say?
Say it again.
No. I mean, like, what combination were you thinking of?
For me.
Yeah.
I'm so confused. What?
No, I mean, didn't you say something like I wasn't thinking of that combination?
Oh, I haven't really thought of, I haven't thought of any combinations, but I just didn't, that one just didn't pop in mind. I think that's smart though, because religion inspires so much of art that I don't know why I didn't make like, oh yeah, film, religion is a big part of film. That's really interesting. I don't know, like Frances Ha is very interesting because like in the sense of it doesn't explore... it doesn't really explore religion, but it also doesn't get to necessarily like the most philosophical questions and doesn't really explore like the most like fundamental things of humanity and culture, but it does feel like it captures the essence of what it's like to be kind of alive in modern society.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's better. I think that's more important because I think that's it's more down to earth, and I think in a sense it captures life a little better than mm-hmm. movies, which would attempt to be about those bigger philosophical questions would. So frankly, Frances Ha, it's my feel-good movie. if I'm ever feeling really, really down or depressed, I'll just watch Francis Ha, and it will cheer me up. And I know that other people have their own selections for what that movie would be for them, but just kind of me and the kind of person that I am, that's the movie for me. And it's, I like, for a little while, I can get this, like, encouraging story of this girl who's not all that put together, but kind of makes it in life anyways. And it tells me that, you know, if
Francis can do it, I can do it. Yeah.
Yeah. If Francis can, like, you know, fix her social life and get on track with her career and make a living and exist in New York, then I can too. There might be little hiccups along the way. You might have to go back and be with your family for a little bit. You might have to rely on, like, the generosity of friends and everything, but that's how it gets done. It gets done just kind of by staying optimistic and keep doing what you're doing. And yeah, I love it.
Life is messy, and I think that this film really makes a point of, like, yeah, Francis is messy, but that's okay. It's like,
but
you know,
and it draws attention to the pleasures of life. It draws attention to just going out to eat, you know, going out to drink, like, having
the dumb jokes you make with your friends.
Yeah, exactly. The dumb jokes you make with friends, like putting on, like, the little dance that she puts on, or like making the omelet. Like, these are all, like, just life is enjoyable. Just, like, find enjoyment in it.
It's the little things.
Yes, it really the little is. Things. Absolutely.
If I can get to the bottom of anything that Baumbach has tried to dig at in his career, he's always obsessed with growth. I think he's obsessed with growing here in your 20s. And, you know, while we're young, I guess Naomi Watts and Ben Stiller are growing and they aren't ready for it. So then they decide to befriend Amanda Seyfried and Adam Driver. And, you know, the growth of the separation of a marriage and Marriage Story, I suppose. And I think he's the growing process of life is something that he's scared of, but also is willing to accept and trying to find ways to deal with in his movies.
Yeah. I mean, I told you about my grandfather that passed, but the thing about that is that he passed a week after I saw While We're Young in the theater. I saw While We're Young in theaters on my 18th birthday. And I gave him a phone call, said, "Hey, just had my 18th birthday. Here's, I saw While We're Young in theaters. I think you'd really enjoy it." And then, like, a week after that, he passed. So
was he also a big movie guy?
Yeah, he was. He introduced me to a lot of great films.
Nice. While We're Young was actually the first Baumbach I've seen, and I don't know if that's a crazy thing to say or not. I don't know typical first Baumbach would be.
It's a fine film.
Yeah, I liked it.
I think there's no issue with it. I just haven't seen it as anyone's favorite.
Yeah.
Maybe it just got lost in the shuffle because
it's the Baumbach.
It came like Francis Ha, While We're Young, and then Mistress America, so it's like maybe it was caught in between those two. Because Greta just kind of shines.
Yeah. Speaking of While We're Young, is this Adam's first Baumbach collaboration?
It is.
Adam Driver? Okay. Interesting.
And then it'll go this, While We're Young, Meyerowitz, Marriage Story.
Who's he in Meyerowitz?
He's someone that works with Ben Stiller. He's like in two scenes.
Okay.
It's like a very small role, yeah.
I kind of had an idea that he was in Meyerowitz, but I forgot who he was. Okay.
Have you seen Meyerowitz?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've seen Meyerowitz. So I've seen four Baumbachs. I've seen Meyerowitz, While We're Young, Francis Ha now. This was my first time seeing Francis Ha, by the way. Marriage.
Do you have
Story.
Any strong takes on Baumbach?
Me? Oh, no, he's good. He's a good writer. This was his best. This is the film that really was like, oh, this is why Baumbach is special. This is why Gerwig. I mean, actually, I knew, like, how is this? Since I kind of, you know, like, Lady Bird, I saw before I think I've seen any Baumbachs, and I'm like, oh, wow, this person's great. So I really knew Gerwig before I knew Baumbach. I didn't really know Bombog. And I know that's not how the world was really introduced to her, but like still. And I was like, and then I saw like 20th Century Women. I might have seen that before while we're young. And so I was really more familiar with Gerwig. And then Baumbach, I'm like, oh, okay, this is the guy people talk about. And while we're young, this is good. I actually really like dig the writing and the acting. And like, I think this is a movie that I don't really watch. He makes movies that people don't watch a lot. I don't like, you know, people compare him to, I've heard comparisons to Wes Anderson. And I think that's, you know, I think
he's written scripts with Wes Anderson.
Really?
Yeah, Fantastic Mr. Fox was co-written by Baumbach.
And Life Aquatic.
Mm-hmm. Huh. You know, yeah. Fantastic Mr. Fox is my favorite Wes Anderson film, actually.
Yes, mine too.
Yeah, I was, I think I had a dream about it.
That's my feel-good movie. That's my feel-good
movie. Oh, I mean, me too. Oh, I don't know why. I like it better than Frances Ha, but I feel like it's... I feel like I can only watch that one around Thanksgiving. I think of it as a Thanksgiving movie.
Yes.
It is for some reason very Thanksgiving-y.
It is very, very autumn-y. It feels like...
There's not many of those, so the ones that come along, you gotta treasure them.
Yeah, Thanksgiving movies are so, like, few and far... Like, you have Plane, Trains, and Automobiles. That's the only one I really think of. And then you have everything else.
Yeah, the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles thing is making me think of Kieslowski again, because I just remember how... how obsessed with transportation Kieslowski is. Like, that would be a Kieslowski film. He would, because he just, every one of his movies just has, like, someone, like, on a boat or on, like, a plane or, like, on a train or on a bus. And, like, every time a character, like, goes in transit from one place to another, something, like, huge happens.
Like, the boat at the end of Red?
Yeah, like that. Yeah. There's like a similar thing that happens with like a plane at the end of Blind Chance, and I mean the train in the middle of Blind Chance. I'm sorry, I'm getting there on tangent.
We're walking the tangents.
I have seen Kicking and Screaming, Squid and the Whale, While We're Young, Frances Ha, and Marriage Story, and of those. My two favorites are Frances Ha and Squid and the Whale. Mm. And the thing about Squid and the Whale is that just like Lady Bird is kind of like it's Greta Gerwig's origin story, Squid and the Whale is Noah Baumbach's origin story. And so you can watch Marriage Story as kind of like the kid from Squid and the Whale all grown up.
Yeah.
And then you can watch Frances Ha as... the girl from Lady Bird all grown up, and Frances Ha and Marriage, like Noah and Gerwig, like right before they meet each other. And so,
and I think Margot at the Wedding is, and Greenberg are the Jennifer Jason Leigh years, and then you get to Frances Ha, Mistress America, and you can separate that into the Greta Gerwig years.
Yeah,
I think I really responded to Squid and the Whale as well, because Jesse Eisenberg's character actually acts and sounds like and reminds me of one of my best friends. So I'm like, oh, hey.
It's, that's very funny.
That's like that connection. Is
one of your best friends Mark Zuckerberg?
Imagine. Yeah. It's like, yeah. So I think, I agree that he's someone that he doesn't. No one makes movies like him, even though you're like, oh, he is kind of Wes Anderson. He's kind of quirky. But you can tell that his influences are very specific, and there's no one that will finance something else like A Marriage Story right now.
Yeah.
Well, not just finance, but Marriage Story is the only drama, to bring back the idea of drama, it's the only drama to come out last year. Almost, where it's like
not the only one, but like it's one of the.
I guess the only one of its crop, I suppose.
Yeah,
or it's
I mean, it's for sure unique. I
feel like that's kind of also like, I think you said this, Julia, of how like Marriage Story became this, for some reason, this cultural moment when it's very much not a cultural moment movie, and that could be the Netflix effect, that could be the Driver ScarJo effect. But it was very interesting how that kind of just like came, like that just all like kind of crystallized into that moment of like, oh yeah, Baumbach, let's talk about him. And I think
because before that, he only had one Oscar nomination for Squid and the Whale screenplay, which is wild.
Yeah, he's not very much that Oscar directed person in the sense of, because like Marriage Story, I would say out of what I've seen would be like, okay, yeah, out of all of his movies, that would be nominated for an Oscar. Not because it's the best, but it's because it's the most genre, or it's the most drama-y, like real life, like, you know, domesticated movie.
It's very much him, but it's also very like him at his most appealing, I think, to like the masses.
I agree.
And again, that part of that could be the Netflix effect.
Yeah, the Netflix effect is interesting. That we'll have to, you know, there might be so much studying about that.
As a filmmaker, I want to know. I want to know, hey, should I sign up with Netflix? Should I get them to kind of, like, handle the release of my movie and everything? And, yeah, these are questions you got to ask yourself.
It's very interesting. Yeah, and like, you know, Marriage Story became very memed. I mean, we'll talk about Marriage Story at one point, I bet.
Yeah, eventually, I'm sure.
But
yeah.
Like, Baumbach, I find some, when I say I don't think many people make movies like him, when I say that, I mean, he's not as surrealist or like almost out there as an Anderson, but he isn't like also like, you know, the most like, he's not like the most realist, like somber filmmaker either. Like he's not grounded in a sense. Like there is in these movies, there are like these moments of this kind of like heightened moments. Like when Frances is following, she's at the fundraiser or whatever, and she's pouring drinks for the senator. And at one point when, you know, she's talking with Sophie and Sophie's like completely like wasted, behind her you see like the senator getting handsy with this student or whatever, and they just start beginning like to caress each other's hair, and then they just start like making out, and like it feels very like heightened, like kind of very like it felt like a Wes Anderson moment in the sense of not a Wes Anderson. I hate doing that, like
I'm so glad that I'm with two people that seem to like Wes Anderson, because I think that he's like one of those directors that kind of like was really popular for a while and then just like retroactively gets a lot of flack from the cinephile community, when really just like there was a reason that he was popular in the first place. I mean, he makes some good stuff. I mean, so does Nolan, so does you know, even Terrence Malick sometimes. So I mean, all these directors, I mean, they have their flaws.
The Terrence Malick.
Yeah, they have their flaws, but they you know.
I think it's the reason why
I think what Clay might be getting at. Noah Baumbach doesn't have a style.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's one that is going to be targeted for parody. And obviously, like, you can be styleless, is that a word? Mm-hmm. And you can still make great shit, but it's like, it's not like he's going to be infamous. I mean, Wes Anderson might have the most infamous style in, like, ever, you know? Like, for a while, to me, the auteur theory only applied to style and, like, visuals. And I'm not sure, I'm always conflicted on whether or not I believe that anymore, but Wes Anderson is the prime example of, like, auteur theory, and it's, like, there's a reason for that. And Noah Baumbach, you kind of get that he has a style in how he writes, you know? And it's interesting that he doesn't write scripts for other people to direct more, because he seems like that's an avenue he'd take.
I mean, Madagascar 3.
What?
That's right. Yeah, oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Interesting. He must have made a good check out of that. That is interesting. No,
I think okay. Let me just like confirm that, because I heard that was if you want to
apparently
take a look.
Yeah, he wrote Madagascar 3, Escape to Africa. Europe's Most Wanted. Escape to Africa was the second one. Silly.
Yeah, he co-wrote it with Eric Darnell.
He's apparently really good friends with Chris Rock, too.
Yeah.
That's a friendship I would be interested in watching. I want Chris Rock in a Noah Baumbach movie this instant. This, like,
yeah, this is like a Noah Baumbach movie starring Chris Rock.
That would be great.
Beautiful.
Oh my god.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that there's these kind of like gateway directors for like teenagers who are interested in like watching movies seriously. They kind of like start with, you know, some of the ones that are kind of more popular and accessible for their demographic, and then that leads them into like more older artsier stuff. But I'm kind of about kind of making peace between kind of like the pop world and the art world. Like there's a lot of gray area in between, and I think you want to kind of give credit and kind of give respect to the people that brought you where you are, you know.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good observation, that that Baumbach is someone that you can recommend to anybody. Because there is a lot going on the surface, but then there is a lot going on underneath the surface, but it's not like it's inaccessible.
Well, I mean, have we wrapped up our thoughts for Francis Law? Any last words anyone wants to say?
I'm so glad I watched this movie. It took me so long. I just want to give one spotlight to Gerwig, because I think she's incredible in this movie.
She's radiant. Yeah.
Crazy. It's like it's a performance. I was just like, oh, this is like a lifetime achievement. Like, I don't know. Like, I was blown away. Like, my only time I've ever seen her act, I think, before this is 20th Century Woman, and she was great in that. But
oh,
like,
she's so good. Oh,
this
man.
Is like a pow. This is like, this is something you can end your career on. Like, yeah. This is something you can have be a part of your legacy. And her to go on to direct two extraordinary movies, and one that captures an energy.
Both nominated
just like,
for Best Picture. Yeah.
And she's also, even through her writing and directing, no matter what role she has, she carries this special energy inside her to everything she does. You know, Lady Bird feels there's a lot of these like special Gerwig or special Greta energy that's also in Frances Ha. There's a lot of that energy in Little Women. Like, she brings her own, you know, atmosphere to everything she does, but also lets the art stand on its own. And I can't say enough about this performance. I just saw it and I'm like, oh, that's a definitive, unimpeachable piece of acting. And I was just blown away.
And yeah, for me, my big Greta Gerwig take, she's always the perfect big sister. Like, the perfect childhood babysitter. She makes you really feel good inside. And it's not to say she doesn't have range, but it's also to say that what you see is kind of what you get. You're right. I mean, she's just, like, a fire hydrant, you know? It's like, she's so spunky and full of life, and you feel like she can conquer the world, but also the world's conquering her. And it's, yeah, I think... If you haven't seen Mistress America, Clay, you should definitely go seek that out. Now.
I mean,
because that is like Greta Gerwig on steroids. Because that there's like a third act that is this whole like rush of like, you know, energy, and we'll be talking about her a lot this decade. So I'm sure we're gonna repeat ourselves.
Not enough. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very modest film. It's got this kind of like quiet, hipster, quirky indie drama kind of like vibe to it from the outside. But on the inside, despite it being just like the 1 hour, 20 minute movie it is, I think there's a lot of power. There's a lot there. So.
And how great is a movie at an hour, 20 minutes? It's just like, and 90 minutes or below, it's just like... Yeah. It's just like perfect feeling of like the moment I saw the runtime, I'm like, oh boy.
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
Just like excited. Oh my God. Yes. I just had this smile on my face. Like, hour 20? Oh, this is going to be great.
And I think that may have contributed to why Noah Baumbach had such a consistent, well respected run while also not getting ahead of himself. I don't know. Not getting ahead of himself.
He didn't jump the shark.
Yeah, he didn't jump the shark. And I think it's because all like, this Mistress America, While We're Young, Greenberg maybe could be included. They're all around the same runtime. Like, it's not like one's 80 minutes, 2.5 hours, 2 hours. You know, I think they're all around hour and 40, 2 hours. So it's like he's very controlled. He's like a very controlled guy.
Marriage Story is
going back to Wes Anderson, actually, where it's like what you see is what you get with that auteur.
Yeah, yeah. I think, I think it's very like. I think he's good, and I think he really works well with Greta, and I think that. But also, I think Greta.
They would make a good couple.
I was wondering, is this like the couple of in the film sphere of the 2010s with their collective work in acting, writing, directing? I can't think of another couple. Like, I mean, like, it's not, I'm not saying they're like the Jay-Z or Beyonce of film, but like, still, it's just like their art and their quality is just
up their specific corner of film. They are.
It's like John Cassavetes and Gina Rollins.
Oh, love them.
Yeah, right.
Well, please invite me back whenever you guys want to do Madagascar 3.
Is that this decade?
That is this decade. Mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, it should be.
2012.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. I've seen.
Well, should we do favorite scene?
Two movies. Let's do favorite scene. So at the end of each podcast, we do our favorite scene in the movie, and I don't even know.
I got mine. If you'd like me to go.
Go.
I think it's the date with Adam Driver. When she got her tax returns, I think. And it's like, she runs down to get to the ATM. She falls down, like, are you bleeding? Like, and he has like that moment where like pauses and he has his hand on a credit card. I think I always get a lot of that scene. It's like what we were saying before about the little things in life that make it so special. It's like, I think the credit card declining is so relatable because it's like awkward for everyone involved, where it's like,
She said, I'm not a real person, I'm like, oh, this is like a masterpiece. Okay, cool. Got it. I understand this now. I understand why this movie is like fucking amazing. Do you have a favorite scene, Julia?
The Modern Love one.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to go with the boring answer, but it's because it's just the best scene. Like, I can't, no other scene can win me over like that one.
I guess I'll have to go with the ending, because I feel like the ending is very much of an encapsulation of the themes. Like, I mean, it is always interesting where so many movies end with like, oh, all of the characters you saw like 30 minutes ago come back in this one moment. You know, it's like this culmination of everything. It happens a lot in movies, but I really liked it this time. Like, I mean, I like it sometimes, but it didn't feel forced this time. It felt natural, and it felt like you said earlier, Julie, about it's like progression. That's what this felt like. It was like an occult. Like, it was like, oh, you know, she's figured it out. She's also like, she's progressed as a human being. She has learned. She has, you know, struggled. She has, you know, fought through adversity in the sense of like her trying to figure all of this out. And it just felt like a perfect little top, or a top, a little perfect little cherry on top. Oh boy. To this whole,
I feel like what your
whole journey.
What you're saying with the final scene, it almost feels like they could all look at the camera and take a bow.
Yes.
Like they're on the verge.
Very much
like
so.
A curt call. Yeah.
Very much so. It was that, like, and also the moment of her looking at Sophie is just like, okay, yeah, that's it. That's the thing.
I feel like sad. Yeah, it's like you were saying before. I feel satisfied.
It's such a satisfied. Yeah, I'm going to be, like, I said this in my Letterboxd review. I'm going to be rewatching this movie a lot as I get older, because it's also very, like, generational, and, like, it really relates to people at a certain age, and just, like, trying to figure it out, like, try not to feel like a complete screw up before you live the rest of your life.
It's kind of like The Graduate.
Yeah. Oh, it's the, I was about to say that. I was about to say this is like The Graduate of our generation.
That's pretty great. That is.
This podcast is full of coincidences. So we'll just like add that to the tally.
Yeah.
God. Yeah. But yeah, Julia, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, this was a delight. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Where can everyone find you on the internet?
Oh, I'm on Essential Films. That's my YouTube channel. And then I'm also on Twitter. And I think that's I think that's it. This is like the YouTube and the Twitter. Oh, Letterboxd. YouTube, Twitter, Letterboxd. Those are my three places that I'm at.
Nice. All so you can plug any.
Julia Rhodes, just all of them. Yeah, just plug it
Julia
in.
Julia Rhodes on.
I'll send you the links.
Dope. Yeah, we're going to definitely pick those out. Jack, can everyone find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Jack A. Draper. And my writing can be found on The Simple Cinephile, Cinema Etc., Cineflix Daily, all those places.
Any new pieces?
I always need reminders to plug these things. You're mm-hmm. It's good that you're like on my shoulder. Mm-hmm. I just had In the Mood for Love retrospective come out. It's like
nice.
No, one of the best ever.
Where can they find that?
On Cineflix Daily.
On Cinefix Daily. Check that out, people. Everyone can find me at ClayFilm100 on Twitter, on Instagram, on Letterboxd. You can follow the podcast account on Twitter at ETTPod. You can leave a voicemail on Anchor. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe. Give us those 5 stars. Next week, we have...
Blue's the Warmest Color with Bow Complex.
That is gonna be great. I'm really excited to have Valerie on. Thank you all so much for listening. Please stay safe. Time of quarantine, very crazy. But stay home, you know, stay safe, stay healthy. We'll get through it. We're gonna be fine. We'll be fine. I promise. Well, I don't promise. I can never promise that. But we appreciate you all for listening. Please check us out next week. And we'll see you next time on Exiting Through the 2010s.